Today is Monday, the 30th of August, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The U.S. carries out an airstrike in Kabul after warning of an imminent threat.
The attack was on a vehicle that was moving towards the airport.
Plus, Hurricane Ida makes landfall in the southern United States.
It appears that hundreds of thousands of people took the opportunity yesterday to leave.
And Washington marks the 58th anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech. We'll have these stories and more next. The United States carried out an airstrike Sunday against a vehicle that posed a threat to the Kabul International Airport. The U.S. attack was carried out following warnings of an imminent attack in the area. Islamic State Khorasan claimed responsibility for that suicide attack outside the airport that killed at least 170 Afghans and 13 U.S. service members last Thursday, and the U.S. airstrike last Friday killed two members of the group. Joining us now from Islamabad is VOA Pakistan and Afghanistan Bureau Chief Aisha Tanzim with the latest.
What we found out is that the attack was on a vehicle that was moving towards the airport that was suspected. So the U.S. carried out an airstrike to destroy that vehicle. And obviously the Taliban were informed about it because we had a message from the Taliban spokesman, Zabihullah Mujahid, as well, that this was a U.S. airstrike. And they said they're investigating the incident. So U.S., they're informing the Taliban when they're carrying out these attacks. As for the condition of the airport, the Taliban are now strictly controlling all access to the airport in Kabul. They have blocked the roads leading to the airport. They have put up checkpoints. They've increased their presence and security. They're not letting any Afghans go through anymore. Only foreigners can cross the checkpoints to go towards the airport. And even the perimeter as well has been pushed out further away from the airport in order to increase security. So gone are the scenes that we saw earlier of thousands of people clamoring to get inside and creating stampedes. That is all a thing of the past now. Now it's orderly, only buses are going to the airport and Taliban are checking lists of passengers that they have with them.
What is the security situation in and around Kabul?
Well, the biggest threat was around the airport because a lot of people had gathered, so it was an easy target. The United States did carry out some attacks in Nangarhar against ISIS targets. The security around Kabul right now is completely under Taliban control, and the Taliban claim that they're going to investigate any attacks in the city. However, that does not mean the city is safe. This is the challenge for the Taliban. They convince the world that they are capable of handling security and making sure no other terrorist group operates from the soil of Afghanistan. Now is the time when they'll have to prove that they actually have the capacity to do it. The airport attack was an easy attack because among thousands of people, it's easy to move. But once the bazaars and everything else in Kabul starts opening up, there could be other places that become just as easy because of just the sheer amount of sheer number of people there. So we will have to wait and see whether the Taliban have the capacity to do security the way they promised. Meanwhile, the United States is going to continue its intelligence-based operations against ISIS targets, as President Biden promised that he would, not just against ISIS, but against Al-Qaeda as well.
VOA's Aisha Tanzim spoke to us from Islamabad, Pakistan, where she's the Afghanistan and Pakistan bureau chief. With U.S. President Joe Biden and their families looking on, the remains of 13 U.S. service members killed in the suicide attack near Kabul International Airport have been returned to the U.S. soil in a dignified transfer at Dover Air Force Base in Delaware. Associated Press correspondent Ben Thomas has more on the fallen.
The 13 U.S. troops included 11 Marines, one Navy sailor, and one Army soldier. They ranged in age from 20 to 31 and came from California, Massachusetts, and states in between. Five were just 20, born not long before the attacks of September 11, 2001, that spurred the United States to invade Afghanistan in hope of toppling al-Qaeda and dismantling their Taliban hosts who ruled the country. The dead include a 20-year-old Marine from Wyoming who had been expecting his first child in 3 weeks, and a 22-year-old Navy corpsman who, in his last FaceTime conversation with his mother, assured her that he would stay safe because he said, "My guys got me." I'm Ben Thomas.
United Nations and private aid agencies say that human rights violations have been surging in Afghanistan since Taliban militants seized control of the country. Lisa Schlein has that part of our coverage.
Aid agencies say Afghanistan is at a very dangerous point. They say an increasingly brutal conflict is worsening the already serious human rights violations in the country. CEO of the Asia-Pacific Refugee Network, Najiba Wazadafost, says many people feared the resurgence of the Taliban as the U.S. and NATO withdrew troops from Afghanistan. But she says few people thought the Taliban would gain control over the country so quickly. She says it is horrifying to see the rapid escalation of human suffering and displacement under Taliban rule.
It has been quite heartbreaking, you know, especially in the past week, receiving vast amount of calls through our Afghan crisis helpline, where people have been reporting executions and beatings and clampdown on media and radio stations. They've been reporting to us about Taliban's, you know, door-to-door searches, targeted killings and looting in the capital. And again, we've been hearing about schools and hospitals and thousands of homes being attacked.
Wazadafo says she is most concerned about the voices of fear she is hearing from women. She says they talk about their fear of being killed simply because they are female. She says she fears border closures because of the pandemic, which will prevent women and girls fleeing violence and persecution from finding safety. Wazadafost is appealing to Western countries that are leaving Afghanistan to not abandon the women and girls left behind and leave them without hope and the support they need to survive their changed circumstances. The United Nations says decades of conflict compounded by a second drought in 4 years and the devastating socioeconomic impact of COVID-19 have wiped out Afghanistan's ability to survive without international support. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says nearly half of Afghanistan's population, about 18 million people, need humanitarian assistance. The head of OCHA's Coordination Division, Wafa Saeed Abdelatif, says at least a third of the population does not have enough to eat and is suffering from acute hunger.
We also estimate that half the children under five are acutely malnourished. And when a child is malnourished, this means also not access to enough food, to health, to water, to hygiene, to sanitation, and also malnutrition have a severe and irreversible impact on children. So this is something that we cannot let continue.
This year's United Nations humanitarian appeal for $1.3 billion has received just $500 million, leaving a funding gap of $800 million. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. Dozens of Yemeni troops have been killed in a missile and drone attack on a key military base in Yemen. AP correspondent Karen Chamas has the details.
Three explosions took place at Al Anad Air Base after a ballistic missile landed in the base's training area, where dozens of troops were doing morning exercises. Graphic footage from the scene showed several charred bodies on the ground with ambulance sirens blaring in the background. It was one of the deadliest attacks in the country's civil war in recent years. Yemen has been embroiled in a civil war since 2014, when Houthi rebels seized the capital, Sana'a, forcing the internationally recognized government into exile. The Saudi-led coalition entered the war the following year on the side of the government. I'm Karen Chamas.
Top Middle Eastern and European leaders discussed the prospects for peace, stability, and economic cooperation between Iraq and its neighbors on Saturday as they gathered in Baghdad for a summit. The leaders of Egypt, Jordan, and France met alongside the foreign ministers of Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Turkey, as well as the Prime Minister of Kuwait. Edward Uranian is up next.
Regional leaders applauded as Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa Kazemi described his hopes for strengthening regional economic, political, and security cooperation to improve the lot of his people following years of turmoil. It was the first large gathering of top Arab leaders in Baghdad since the 2012 Arab summit. The presence of Iran's new foreign minister, Hussein Amir Abdullahian, at the summit provided a glimmer of optimism for a thaw in relations between Tehran and its top regional adversaries, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. Speaking in Arabic, Abdullahian held out an olive branch to Arab states. He says that Iran would like to improve relations with countries in the region through economic and cultural cooperation without what he called the usual interference from international powers. Foreign interference, he argues, has created tensions and regional insecurity. French President Emmanuel Macron, the only major world leader to attend the summit, praised the Iraqi government for defeating Islamic State, urging Baghdad to help resettle Iraqis who were displaced by the conflict and vowing French aid to do so. Speaking in a rapid clip, Saudi Foreign Minister Faisal bin Farhan spoke of Riyadh's ongoing cooperation with Iraq while vaguely referring to stopping Iranian interference in Iraq and elsewhere. He says Saudi Arabia has earmarked money for various projects in Iraq and reaffirms its support for Iraq's stability and putting an end to terrorism and extremism alongside the U.S.-led international coalition. He says that is in keeping with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's initiative for regional peace and stability and ending meddling by certain regional states. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi alluded to a recent economic and political alliance between Iraq, Egypt, and Jordan, and efforts to extend cooperation to other countries in the future. He spoke of the past achievements of Iraq's long civilization and better times that await it. Al-Sisi talks of cooperation with Iraq and wider regional cooperation built on regional interests and stronger ties to fight major threats like terrorism and COVID-19. He says Egypt will continue to support the Iraqi government to achieve stability, adding that the long civilization and history of Iraq give hope for a brighter future if Iraqis defend their country, rebuild their cities, and choose their leaders wisely. Khatar Abu Diab, who teaches political science at the University of Paris, tells VOA that Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa Kazemi scored points with his ability to bring so many regional players to Baghdad with at least a modicum of success in lessening tensions among various adversaries. He says this is something of a symbolic summit, but it represents a step toward less conflict and more dialogue in a region that already is overly tense and conflictual. He argues that the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan has left regional players tired and nervous, and after the U.S. has stopped playing umpire, many of the players are seeking a truce. Paul Sullivan, who is a Washington-based Middle East analyst, tells VOA he doesn't expect much to come out of this meeting in Baghdad, but he thinks that human development and human security need lots of work and lots of cooperation, despite what he calls the stark differences of views among the countries attending the Baghdad summit. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Hurricane Ida made landfall in the U.S. Gulf Coast state of Louisiana on Sunday as a Category 4 storm with 240-kilometer-per-hour winds on the Saffir-Simpson scale of hurricane intensity. The storm's arrival comes 16 years after Hurricane Katrina's onslaught. As Arash Arabasadi reports, the memories of Katrina still loom large.
Area business owners boarded up windows ahead of Sunday's landfall. At a virtual briefing with federal emergency personnel on Saturday, U.S. President Joe Biden warned those in the region to stay alert throughout the storm.
I'm urging the people of the area to pay attention and be prepared. I want to say it again, pay attention and be prepared. Have supplies for your household on hand. Follow the guidance from local authorities. And if you have to move to shelter, make sure you wear a mask and try to keep some distance, because we're still facing a highly contagious Delta variant as well.
Louisiana currently has less than 41% of its population vaccinated against the coronavirus, according to USAFacts.org. Still, some residents aren't even considering an evacuation. Austin Suriano helped board up his father's watch repair shop and spoke with AFP.
We're going to stay because, you know, just in case if it's a bad hurricane, people going to want loot. So we got to keep our eye on the store.
Other residents have no plan to tempt fate. Area resident Shamika Minari Woods tells Reuters it's time to go.
We decided to take off. Yeah, because just like with Hurricane Katrina, we're not trying to be here for the disaster. So we ain't taking no chances. We're leaving.
Ida's landfall in the United States comes exactly 16 years after Hurricane Katrina ravaged the Gulf Coast. More than home to millions of Americans, the area is an industrial hub with three ports and a nuclear power plant. Speaking Sunday on CBS's Face the Nation, Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards said lots of people listened to expert advice.
It appears that hundreds of thousands of people took the opportunity yesterday to leave, especially in those low-lying areas in southeast Louisiana along the coast, those that are not protected by our much-enhanced hurricane and storm risk reduction system. We asked people to make sure that when they went to bed last night, they were prepared to ride out the storm and that they would go to bed where they intended to ride out the storm.
The governor says the most populated areas should be protected from storm surges following a $14 billion investment in the years since Katrina. Hurricane Ida smashed into Cuba Saturday on its way to the United States, flooding roads and agricultural areas in its path. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists theorize that some 13.8 billion years ago, the universe began to form after the Big Bang. It's generally thought that the universe was dark for its first several hundred million years. A study led by researchers at University College London and the University of Cambridge proposes the first stars and galaxies began to form 250 to 300 million years after the Big Bang, during a period they call the Cosmic Dawn. Using data from the Hubble and Spitzer space telescopes, the researchers studied a few galaxies that formed when the universe was only about 550 million years old. The study also suggests NASA's new James Webb Space Telescope, set to launch in November, will be so responsive that it will allow a look further back in time to watch the birth of the first galaxies. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Australian drug regulators have approved the use of the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine for children between the ages of 12 and 15. Phil Mercer takes it from here.
The Australian Technical Advisory Group on Immunisation has advised the federal government that the Pfizer vaccine is safe and effective for children ages 12 to 15. The drug regulators have insisted that the benefits of COVID-19 vaccination for children of that age range far outweigh the potential risks, including myocarditis, where the heart muscle is inflamed. Australia's Federal Health Minister Greg Hunt says he hopes most injections will be given by the end of the year.
We're in a position to ensure that all children and all families who seek their children to be vaccinated between the ages of 12 to 15 will be able to do so this year.
The Pfizer vaccine was already available to Australian Aboriginal children ages 12 to 15 who have underlying medical conditions or live in remote areas. France, Italy and Israel started offering the Pfizer vaccine to anyone aged 12 and older in June. Japan did so in May, and the United States recently approved the drug's use for that age group. The vaccines have been approved for children in India, but officials haven't decided when inoculations can begin. Paul Griffin, an associate professor in the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Queensland, supports Australia's decision to offer vaccines to younger children.
We have seen excellent data supporting the use of these vaccines in this age group. Other countries have started doing it, and we know it's an important age group to be vaccinated for so many reasons. Children are now increasingly recognised as contributing to the spread of this virus.
The Australian Medical Association also supports the vaccination of children, but has said that some older age groups are more of a priority. Teachers in New South Wales, Australia's most populous state, face mandatory coronavirus vaccinations as authorities plan a return to school for students starting in late October. In Australia, 34.4% of the population is fully vaccinated. 4 weeks ago, it was 19.5%. 15 million Australians remain in lockdown, including residents in Sydney, Melbourne and Canberra, as Delta variant infections continue to surge. New South Wales authorities reported 1,218 additional COVID-19 cases Sunday, a new daily record. Australia has detected about 50,000 coronavirus infections since the pandemic began, and 993 people have died, according to the health department. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The Botswana government has assured thousands of illegal immigrants that they will not be left out of the COVID-19 vaccination program. The promise was made amid reports some were being rejected at vaccination centers. But Kandisi Dube reports.
Thousands of illegal immigrants are crossing into Botswana, the majority fleeing economic hardships in neighboring Zimbabwe. Some undocumented migrants say they are being turned away from vaccination centers, but Botswana's Assistant Minister of Health, Sithumo Lila-Tidzu, told the National Assembly Friday no one, including immigrants, will be left out of the COVID-19 vaccination program. He said they have immigrants and they are vaccinating them. Even those without documents, including refugees, are being vaccinated for COVID-19 because if they leave them out, their hospitals will be full tomorrow. Lilati Sisutse said. Member of Parliament Ditapelo Kiorapetsi had asked during a National Assembly session whether illegal immigrants were being vaccinated. He said the migrants should be made aware of the service. He said he didn't understand why a record isn't being kept about the number of migrants who have been vaccinated in order to assist, inform and formulate a solid policy. He also said the migrants need to know they are eligible for vaccination. Mkululi Moyo is one of thousands of immigrants from neighboring Zimbabwe. He left his country seeking better economic opportunities. Moyo says his happy Botswana authorities have explained the policy on the vaccination of migrants.
I'm so happy because now Minister, he managed to clarify this issue of papers, especially us foreigners. We have this problem. So now it means everything is well now. We hope everything will go smooth according to what Minister has said, meaning everyone is going to be vaccinated.
Health authorities are emphasizing now they are unconditionally assisting undocumented migrants. Botswana deports an estimated 22,000 illegal immigrants every year, mostly from Zimbabwe. Mkondisi Dube for VOA News, Haburoni, Botswana.
As Haiti recovers from a quake that struck the country nearly 2 weeks ago, relatives bury a girl near the ruins of their house. She's among the more than 2,200 people that have been killed by the 7.2 magnitude earthquake. And elsewhere, women say that they fear for their safety and for that of their children. We have more with VOA correspondent Mariama Diallo.
Relatives weep at the funeral of a girl named Razna, who would have turned 11 this month. She perished when a 7.2 magnitude quake hit Haiti's southern peninsula nearly 2 weeks ago. Her father, Ronald Louis Jean, told Agence France-Presse she died shortly after the quake.
The house collapsed with her inside it. She wasn't dead yet, but I couldn't find people to help me get her out from under the wall. By the time I managed to find people to help me, she had passed on. I lived through my daughter's death. all her agony.
Razna was buried near the ruins of a house in Marceline. Over 2,200 people were killed in the earthquake in a nation that is still recovering from another devastating quake about a decade ago. In another part of town, at a makeshift camp, women survivors talk about the difficult conditions they face and their fears for their safety and that of their children. Earthquake survivors Vesta Guerrier and Francis Dorismont also spoke with Agence France-Presse.
We have no access to toilets. We can't pee. Everyone is looking at you. We need adequate space to wash. At any moment, you can see a torch. You don't know if they are from here or somewhere else because it's an open field.
I have three children. We've been sitting here under sheets since Saturday. We can't go home because our house is destroyed. We have nowhere to live.
On Thursday, the United States pledged more money in aid to the victims. U.S. Agency for International Development Administrator Samantha Power speaking in Port-au-Prince with Haitian Prime Minister Ariel Henry.
I am pleased here to announce
that USAID will provide an additional $32 million as part of a broader American response.
Le gouvernement haïtien a fait face à un pile de défis.
The Haitian government is facing a lot of challenges.
Nous avons des difficultés politiques.
We have political difficulties.
Nous avons des difficultés économiques.
We have economic difficulties.
But despite all these issues, he says his government is doing its best to address the current challenges. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
And finally, thousands of Americans gathered on Saturday in Washington, D.C. to demand federal legislation to protect voting rights. Saqib Islam reports from the protest, March on Our Voting Rights, which also marked the 58th anniversary of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr.'s historic I Have a Dream speech on the National Mall.
The movement is the same as it was 58 years ago with the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., and so is the message.
It's important because Dr. King was here, and Dr. King secured the Voting Rights Act of 1965. This is a continuation of that effort. We are here to protect what Dr. King secured.
We came to strategize, organize, and mobilize.
This year's march on Washington is aimed at reversing changes to the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Made by the U.S. Supreme Court in a 2013 decision.
It's a racist system. It's a system that wasn't built for fairness or equality. So our votes matter.
With gerrymandering and voter suppression and the different things that a certain party is doing to keep people from being able to vote easily, they're stripping. They're stripping American citizens from a basic right.
This year, several Republican-controlled state legislators have passed bills that tighten the rules around casting ballots and running elections. Supporters of the new laws say they are necessary to prevent election fraud and that the John R. Lewis Advancement Act of 2021, which would restore elements of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 and recently passed the U.S. House, is unnecessary.
So there's no threat to the voting rights law. It's against the law to discriminate in voting on the basis of race already. And so I think it's unnecessary.
We haven't had fraud in this country in elections since probably the turn of the previous century. The last election, there was almost zero voter fraud. This is just an excuse to take away our right to vote.
Protesters here were pushing for several new laws that they say will help protect voters' access to ballots.
If it were possible to eliminate gerrymandering, to make it easier for people to register to vote, to make it easier for people who don't have identification to get an ID card.
Along with voting rights, many here were also demanding that elected officials push for Washington, D.C. statehood. 140 organizations organized this march, during which Member of Congress, along with Martin Luther King III, vowed to to protect democracy, make DC a state, and ensure fair and easy access to the ballot box. Saqib Ul Islam, VOA News, Washington.
And this has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.